On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. To understand the unrest in Iraq and throughout the Middle East, it's critical to understand the tensions between Sunni and Shia Muslims. The two groups have coexisted peacefully for centuries with some period of unrest, but nothing like the clash happening today in Iraq. Shiites are a minority within Islam, but the last century they have come to dominate politics in the Middle East. This hour, On Point, we'll examine the Sunni-Shia divide in the Middle East and what it means for world politics. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Mike Schuster. He is a diplomatic and foreign correspondent for NPR. He has traveled often to the Middle East to cover stories in Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Last week, Morning Edition featured his five-part series called The Partisans of Ali, a history of Shia faith and politics, which followed the origin of the Sunni-Shia divide and the Shiites' rise to power. Mike Schuster, it's so great to have you here. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome, Jane.
Before we delve into history and faith and politics, will you briefly set the table for our conversation this hour and explain why it is so critical to understand Sunni and Shiite Muslims in the Middle East today?
I guess at bottom, it's because they're fighting each other in Iraq. The war is very bloody. The use of violence is profound. And the United States and U.S. forces there, in some sense, are in the middle. There is a Shiite government, a Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad, that the United States, as a result of the invasion, allowed to come to power, that has close relations with the United States on the one hand and Iran on the other, because many of the political leaders and political parties that are now in power in Baghdad were supported by Iran for many years. So there is a very complex and very violent conflict in Iraq that involves Sunni and Shia, with the United States in some sense in the middle. And now, after last November's election, where the mood of the public on Iraq has shifted, it seems that it seemed worthwhile to get into this issue more deeply to help those of our listeners who are interested to understand the situation better.
So take us back, Mike. What are the origins of the split between Sunni and Shiite Islam?
It's a very interesting history, and it goes to the very roots of the religion of Islam. I don't claim to be an expert in the religion, but I talked to many historians and experts who essentially explained it. It had to do with who would lead the small community of Muslims in Arabia after the death of Muhammad in the year 632. And there were two different points of view about whom God wanted to lead the Muslims. Some said the community or the community elders should decide. That was the majority, and they became the Sunni later on. But a minority wanted someone connected to Muhammad or Muhammad's family, and they settled on Ali, who was his son-in-law and who had married his daughter Fatima. The Sunni or majority view prevailed. Ali did not lead the Muslims initially, although he was eventually to lead them. But this set the stage for conflict in Arabia and among the community of Muslims, and eventually it led to a split between Sunni and Shia.
You mentioned the conflict. Has the violence always existed between the two? Has there ever been some sort of reconciliation?
Well, the two branches of Islam, as I understand it, have never united or reunited after the initial split. But of course, there have been periods. This is a 14-century history, and there have been periods of time when the two branches coexisted in parts of the world where they were dominant peacefully, and there have been other times when the two branches were in conflict. And this is also part of the political history of the Middle East and the wider Muslim world, and these branches of Islam came to be identified with leaders, rulers, emperors, kings, and in the modern day political leaders, and so that that politics became intricately woven with the faith as well.
Well, let's talk about that. I want to play a clip from your series to speak to the point of how Shiites began to establish their political power. During the 16th century, the Shiites established their dynasty in Persia, which is now modern-day Iran, which gave themselves a foothold in the Middle East.
Now the geography of Shiite Islam was largely established and would prevail into the 20th century. There were periods of conflict and periods of peace, but the split remained and would, in the second half of the 20th century, turn out to be one of the most important factors in the upheavals that have ravaged the Middle East. Again, Ray Takei.
Why has there been such a prolonged and protracted disagreement and tension between these two sects? Well, it has to do with political power.
In the 20th century, that meant a complex political dynamic involving Sunni and Shia, Arabs and Persians, colonizers and colonized, oil, and the involvement of the superpowers.
Mike Schuster, how did the Shia then increase their political power in the 20th century?
Well, what's interesting is that there have been two traditions, scholars say, within the Shia faith about relationship to politics or relationship to leaders. The predominant tradition has been what they call a quietist one, which was that Shia clerics living throughout the Middle East essentially accepted the rule of monarchs and political leaders as long as those political leaders did not interfere in the realm of religion and pursued their political power in a way that would protect religion. That began to fall apart, particularly in Iran in the 20th century, with the coming of the Pahlavi dynasty in 1925, and then the Shah, the most recent last Shah in the 1940s. As a result of pressure on the Shah and the collapse of his throne in 1953 and turmoil in Iran that saw the CIA and British intelligence overthrow a nationalist prime minister and bring back the Shah. The Shah created a secret police that went after political dissidents and political opposition ruthlessly. And as a result, the only place in Iran where there could be political protest was in the mosque. And so the Shia clergy then became a place of political discontent and political protest against the Shah. And there emerged a leader within that, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, who in the 1950s and 1960s became the most outspoken critic of the Shah of Iran. He eventually went into exile and actually went to Najaf in Iraq for more than a decade, where he developed a completely different idea about what the relationship between the Shia clergy and political power should be. Khomeini essentially developed the revolutionary idea that that the monarch or the political leaders of Iran could no longer be trusted to protect religion, and so they needed to be challenged, eventually overthrown, and political power placed in the hands of the clerics. And that happened in 1978 and 1979. When the Shah was forced from power, Khomeini returned, and the first steps were taken to create an Islamic Republic, a Shiite Islamic Republic. Now, we're in America, we're familiar with somewhat of these events to some degree, especially because American diplomats were taken hostage during that period for more than a year. What emerged, though, I think in a way that Americans aren't fully aware of, is that a new Shiite politics in the Middle East emerged. The Iranian Revolution had a great effect beyond its borders, both negative and positive, in different parts of the Middle East. There was positive reaction and there was negative reaction, particularly among some Sunni leaders in the Sunni states that are close to the United States. So this had repercussions that continued and continued and continued. And when the United States overthrew Saddam Hussein after the invasion in 2003, these politics came to the fore because in Iraq, the majority of people are Shiites and are well aware of this history and these developments, and in a way that I don't think either political leaders in the United States or the public fully understood.
Beyond what you have just said, the Shia are a minority in the Muslim world, right? 10-15% of the Muslim population.
Across the Muslim world, they're a minority, but they are the overwhelming majority in Iran, and they are a strong minority in they are an overwhelming majority in Iran and a strong majority in Iraq. Given the importance of Iran and Iraq to the world, the amount of oil that both produce,
right,
they become very, very important.
And that's also where they draw much of their power.
Yes. I mean, they draw their power because of their numbers and because of the importance of Iran and Iraq and the Persian Gulf and the wider world, because both are such important oil producers.
So the prospects of the Shia generally in the Middle East, how has Iran affected that?
Well, I think in a very complex way. The history is interesting. As many of us know, there was a long war between Iraq and Iran in the 1980s. When Saddam Hussein was in power, he invaded Iran during the turmoil of Iran's revolution in 1980. But the war lasted for 8 years. And much of it was fought, when it was fought in Iraq, it was fought in the areas where Shiites lived in southern Iraq. At the same time, there were many opponents of Saddam Hussein who fled to Iran, and they created political parties in Iran, and sometimes they fought against Iraq during that war. And those political parties came into Iraq after the U.S. invasion.
My guest this hour is NPR's Mike Schuster. Morning Edition featured his five-part series last week on the origin of the Shia-Sunni split in Islam. Mike, I want to play another clip from your series to talk more about the Iranian Revolution and why it was so significant. In the 50s, Ayatollah Khomeini started to challenge the rule of the Shah, and then by the late 70s, there was a full-blown revolution on the streets.
In 1978, a popular movement exploded in the streets of Iran's cities, aimed at overthrowing the Shah. Reported here by the BBC.
There's been a major battle going on here for the last half hour, very much shooting, and the people are trying to take on the tanks. They're throwing Molotov cocktails from the rooftops, and a huge tank just in front of me now, going down the road, going through all the fires, and people here are throwing Molotov cocktails at them.
From exile, Ayatollah Khomeini emerged as the revolution's leader. And in early 1979, after the Shah fled the country, Khomeini returned.
This is a man they call the father of the revolution. And this is the moment that millions in Iran have been waiting for. After his long years in exile, the first hesitant steps of Ayatollah Khomeini on Iranian soil.
Mike Schuster, how did the revolution strengthen the Sunni-Shia split?
Well, it was a very, very tumultuous time in Iran. When you read accounts and do some research about it, you find that there were all sorts of political impulses. There were leftists and pluralist Democrats and different political factions, and there were communists involved, and there were the Shiite clerics and Khomeini himself. And through all this turmoil, the one figure that stood out and brought everyone together was Khomeini. Even though he didn't have a set of political beliefs that were all inclusive, and in fact, in the very early days of the revolution, he set about focusing a political process that could bring power into the hands of the cleric. They wrote a constitution, and it embodied an idea that Khomeini had developed in exile, which loosely translates into rule of the jurisprudent, but in actual practical terms, created a position in Iran called the supreme leader or the supreme religious leader, and put nearly all political power into his hands, not into the hands of the president. They also created a parallel political structure, a president and a parliament. And as this has evolved over the last few decades, we see this complex situation in Iran today where there are multiple centers of power, where a president like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the current president, can get elected, say a lot of things, look to the Western world like he's the powerful leader of Iran, but in fact is not, because he doesn't hold all the power. The supreme leader holds much more of it, who functions more in the background and has much more to say about the foreign policy of Iran. Against that backdrop, there was a great deal of influence beyond Iran's borders in the 1980s, brought on war with Iraq. There was opposition in Saudi Arabia, which is Sunni, but there was a lot of excitement in the streets in different parts of the Arab and Muslim world, because this revolution overthrew a very, very powerful monarch. And so what Shiite politics from the 1980s in Iran seemed to say to the wider Muslim world is, you can do this. Tyrants and rulers that are not satisfactory and are not advancing your societies are vulnerable, and we can show you the way.
And to
some degree, that sort of played out during the 1990s and into the current century in other parts of the Middle East.
One of the most important reverberations of the revolution, would you say, was in Lebanon, when Hezbollah born during that time?
Hezbollah was born in the early 1980s as a result of the Israeli invasion in 1982 of Lebanon. The Iranians were involved in it, but again, it was because there was fertile political and social soil for this, because the Shiites were considered second-class citizens to some degree in Lebanon. They are not a majority, but they are a large minority. And when the Israelis invaded, they invaded through southern Lebanon, through Shiite territory. And so there was a kind of nationalist impulse to confront the Israelis. But there was also a certain level of Shiite politics. Iran was involved. Iran sent figures to Lebanon to help organize these militias, the defense militias that have eventually coalesced into Hezbollah.
In your reporting, you talk about a critical period some years later after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and after the U.S. ousted Iraq from Kuwait. The Shiites rose up against Saddam, and he put down that rebellion quite brutally. At that time, you say no one came to their assistance but Iran. Was that a particularly significant moment for Shiites?
That seemed to me a very particularly tragic moment and a very important moment for Shiites. I remember this because I was part of the team that covered the first Gulf War for NPR. In fact, what happened was that there was a rebellion. Saddam Hussein's rule and his army were so badly hurt by the U.S. victory in Kuwait that the Shiites in the south and the Kurds in the north as well thought that he was vulnerable, and they rebelled against him. But the United States had signed a truce with Saddam Hussein before those rebellions occurred, and President Bush at the time decided not to aid those rebellions, even in small ways that might have helped them succeed. And Saddam Hussein killed a lot of people, tens of thousands of Shiites, in the south. And it made the Shiite clergy and many who lived there very bitter about the United States, that they came to the conclusion that the United States, which had called for their rebellion and the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, but then did nothing to help it, was not a friend and not a supporter. And not much is known about the 1990s in southern Iraq, at least by Western scholars that I talked to and historians. But it seemed that as a result of this, the Shiite population in southern Iraq began, even in the 1990s, to turn more toward the clergy and toward their religious faith to see them through this. And as a result, it was also true that Saddam Hussein in the 1990s seemed to set about a campaign of murder against the Ayatollahs and senior clerics in southern Iraq. And a lot of them were killed, murdered by Saddam's agents. It was a particularly bad time in the 1990s for the Shiite population.
You also talk in your reporting about the significance of the imams being a fundamental difference that separate the Sunni and Shia. How so? Can you explain that?
Well, the Shia viewed Ali and his sons and then those that came after him in who are descended, all of whom are viewed as descending from Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad. They called them imams, and they were the clerical leaders of the community. And they were imbued, as I understand it, with a kind of religious aura that was different than the clerics on the Sunni side. And over the course of several centuries after the death of Muhammad, the imams prevailed and led Shia Islam. But in the 10th century, one imam, the 12th, or what they call the hidden imam, went into a state of what the worshippers and the believers say is occultation. He disappeared and was hidden by God because of dangers at the time. And Shia faithful, not all Shiites, but most Shiites, believe that someday God will return the hidden imam to earth in a kind of Messiah-like way who will bring perfect justice on earth. And this is one of the core beliefs among Shiites, or at least the majority of Shiites in the world today. And it carries through into the present time. You hear in both Iraq and Iran Even political leaders talk about this as a central belief in their religious approach to life.
I want to take a call. Many listeners are lined up to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones with Sultan, who is calling from Salem, New Hampshire. Sultan, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Thank you.
Mike, very great. Nice series the whole week. I listened to all of them. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
There is a difference between Shia and Sunni. And I lived in very Shia communities, and we have problems here, there, sporadic violence there, but not to the extent that, you know, this the one we see these days. But I think it's basically more like a political thingy that these people, Middle Eastern, very repressive regimes, and they are making this thing too much to save their power and distract people from the fact that the difference is not as bad as it to the extent.
What about that, Mike Schuster?
Pardon me?
Thank you for your call, Sultan.
I understand what the caller is saying. It's just that we are in this situation in Iraq where sectarian violence, particularly over the past year, has deepened. And now we have a great deal of violence between the Sunni insurgents on the one hand and the Shiite militias on the other. Ultimately, this conflict will end. I believe that Iraq will remain a single state, and there will be a political reconciliation of some kind at some point, some kind of unified government. But until then, and as long as American troops are in Iraq, I think it's an important conflict that we need to understand as best as we can.
Another call from Alston, Massachusetts for Mike Schuster. Tim is calling. Tim, you're on the line. Go ahead. Tim, are you there? Let's go to Tony. He's calling from Eastover, South Carolina. Tony, are you there?
Oh.
Go ahead, Tony.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
A question for Mr. Schuster. The question I have is the Arab-Israeli conflict. If there were more effort, or at least more effort being placed on that problem, or maybe even a solution to that problem, do you think that the imams in the Sunni and the Shia camps would be less extreme or less combative against U.S. interests or British interests in the Middle Eastern region? And I'll take my answer from him off the air.
Good question. Thank you.
I think that if there was a movement toward or political progress, let's say, between Israel and the Palestinians, it would help to alleviate tensions across the Middle East and help to alleviate hostility against the United States across the Middle East. To what degree might it affect the war in Iraq? I'm not sure, and I kind of doubt that it would have any direct effect because the conflict in Iraq now is among Iraqis about Iraq and the future of Iraq. But certainly, if there were progress on the Israeli-Palestinian front, it's a good bet that there would be help for the United States. And it would also begin to diminish one of the strong claims of al-Qaeda and other terrorists who are fighting the United States about U.S. policy. So I guess in some sense, the U.S. policy, because U.S. policy is deeply embedded in Iraq and in the wider Middle East, there is a connection. But it's about the United States, it seems to me, and the Middle East. It's not about Iraqi against Iraqi.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Let's go to Plainville, Connecticut. Sophia is on the line for Mike Schuster from NPR. Sophia, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to add a comment, and that is that a lot of people don't understand why it's so significant that 1,400 years ago, the Shiites wanted one person to be the supreme leader, and why is this conflict still going on? The fact is that the Shiites have been an oppressed minority, totally persecuted, for 1,400 years. And right now, Iran has been painted as the villain of the peace, that they are supporting the Shiites everywhere. But where are the hidden people who are supplying the money and the arms for the other side of this conflict? There are large persecuted minorities in this day and age in Saudi Arabia, in Bahrain, and all Sunni majority areas. And that is never brought up. I wonder why.
Sophia, thank you. Villain of the peace. Does that sound right, Mike Schuster?
Well, it's certainly true that she points to an important relationship between within Saudi Arabia, there is a minority Shiite community that has been oppressed in the past. They live in eastern Saudi Arabia. In fact, they live quite close to some of the most important oil fields in the Middle East. And as a result of tensions in between Sunni and Shia, there has been, as I understand it, some effort on the part of the Saudi monarchy and the Saudi royal family to alleviate some of the worst abuses toward Shiites in Saudi Arabia. But we don't know a great deal about this. It's difficult to report on it and get a real fix on where things stand. But it's an important aspect in the wider Middle East, the relationship of Saudi Arabia's Shiites to the Saudi society. Mm. And everything that scholars and historians told me about the treatment of Shiites, much of the treatment of Shiites in most parts where they have large communities, is that they have been considered second-class citizens by the Sunni majority and the Sunni rulers.
Speaking of Saudi Arabia, one more call from Steve in Brooklyn, Iowa. Steve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to know what is or where does the Wahhabi sect of Islam fit into the equation of Shiite and Sunni, and I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
The Wahhabis. Thank you. Wahhabis.
The Wahhabis are very conservative Sunni clerics in Saudi Arabia. They have a close relationship to the Saudi monarchy. They back or have in the past, many of them have backed al-Qaeda or have spoken out in favor of al-Qaeda. It has caused tension within Saudi Arabia. And at times, they have vilified the Shiites. The most extreme Sunni groups view Shiism as heresy. And in fact, there have been times that Osama bin Laden and others in al-Qaeda and some Wahhabi leaders have called for war against the Shiites, or called for, have essentially said that it is not a sin to either kill Shiites or fight Shiites or reject Shiism. So my understanding is that if the problem of the Shiites in Saudi Arabia is to be resolved, that kind of extremism on the part of some clerics will have to be dealt with as well.
Actually, we'll take one more call from Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, go ahead. You're on the line.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I mean, insofar as this conversation is about how America understands the Shia and the Sunni, I think it's important vis-a-vis Iraq to understand why the Shia and the Sunni both view the United States as the enemy. And because there are no friends in international product, you know, in international relationships, they're just interests. And our interests in the Middle East in that area is solely about oil.
Mike, are Sunni and Shia both enemies of the United States?
I don't think that that's true. And I don't think you can say that across the board. The insurgency in Iraq is primarily a Sunni phenomenon, fighting because the United States overthrew a government that and a leader that they were loyal to. And because, as a minority, they have essentially been ousted from power, and are not happy with a different status in what might be in the new Iraq in the future. Certainly, the Shiites, who are now in power, have the United States to thank for setting in motion this political process. But at the same time, their world, their political world, is far more complex than may be appreciated in the United States. Because, as I said earlier, because of their backing from Iran for many years, in exile and against Saddam Hussein, they're naturally going to want to have a better, more friendly relationship with Iran, and a relationship that won't lead to war again. And that may then make them look like they're enemies of the United States, because now the Bush administration is focusing so much of its perhaps more belligerent rhetoric against Iran.
Can I ask more about that? Because mm-hmm. America has supported Middle East governments led by mostly Sunnis, and now in Iraq we're backing a Shiite government that has close and really cordial ties with the Shiite government, as you mentioned, in Iran. Seems like a policy of contradictions, is it not?
It is a policy of contradiction. If you look at the history of American policy in the Middle East, not just recently, but over the last half century, you'll find a lot of contradictions. Or what seems to me more is that the United States has often had different foreign policy goals in the Middle East, some of which are irreconcilable, some of which fight one another. And I think that we see that with the United States in Iraq right now, that the United States is supporting the Shiites in Iraq, but opposing the Shiite government of Iran that is friendly with the Shiite government in Iraq. It's a policy of contradictions or perhaps irreconcilable goals. I don't think that the public here appreciates the difficulty to reconcile these goals as much as they ought to.
Well, then, to continue that thought, to the extent that tensions and perhaps even violence increases between U.S. and Iran, how likely is it that we would see Shiite Muslims in Iraq taking the side not of the Americans, but of their fellow Shiites in Iran?
Very likely. This is an issue that came up repeatedly in the conversations and interviews that I did with experts in the region. And they said essentially that if it comes to conflict between the United States and Iran, it is unlikely that the Shiite government in Iraq will end up siding with the United States. And it makes sense because Iraq and Iran are neighbors. They have a direct relationship with each other, a direct effect on one another, and they've had a violent past. And it's quite clear that the new government in Baghdad, the Shiite government, doesn't want to see that repeated again.
I'd like to play more from your series, Mike, which, by the way, was just terrific. In the last part
Thank you.
The series, you point out some of the unexpected results of invading Iraq for the United States. And, of course, that is a loss of stability. I want to listen to Daniel Brumberg of Georgetown University and political scientist Aman Shaheen.
Unfortunately, what we didn't see was the cost in terms of taking decisions which would so undermine the legacy of political stability as to create a desire in some camps, and you see this in Iraq now, for some kind of revival of autocracy that would bring at least a measure of peace and security to everyday Iraqis. It is certainly one of the paradoxes of the American intervention in Iraq.
All it seems, at least in part, because the U.S. paid little or no attention to the history of the region, the troubled history of the split in the Muslim world between Shiite and Sunni. That's the view of Palestinian political scientist Ayman Shaheen.
You worked against the history. You did not recognize the history of the region. So if you want to build a new thing, even your new policy should be based on history. But your policy was based on nothing.
So when American foreign policy crashed into all that history, Mike Schuster, is the most significant outcome of this war in Iraq the fact that the divide has been deepened in the Islamic world?
Well, that's certainly the view of a lot of the historians that I talk to. It is not only now a violent conflict within Iraq with no clear end in sight, but it's having an effect in the wider Middle East. It's increasing tension in the wider Middle East between Shiite and Sunni. And we don't know what unforeseen events may occur as a result of this. A lot of the fear or worry among experts is about the stability of Saudi Arabia, about the possibility that Sunnis in the wider Arab world will find fault with the Saudis because they didn't come to the support of their Sunni country, allies in Iraq. There's just a fear that this is getting out of control, and unforeseen repercussions will occur, and it will spread conflict. It's not that we know that this is going to happen, but among experts, there's a great worry that events are out of control now.
And perhaps the biggest irony is that Iran's position in the region has been strengthened with the overthrow of the Taliban and Saddam Hussein.
That's certainly true. The Bush administration tried to deny that for some years, and they don't seem to be denying it any longer. But I used a quote from Michael Hayden, the new director of the CIA, who was testifying before Congress earlier this year. And he said that Iraq has to be a barrier to Iranian expansion rather than a bridge. But it seems to me and many of the experts that I talked to that the very opposite has occurred, that in fact Iraq is a bridge to Iranian expansionism, or at least the expansion of Iranian influence in the region. There's no question about it. And it is highly unlikely that the United States is going to be able to persuade Iraq's Shiite leaders to be anything but that.
After Saddam Hussein's government was toppled in Iraq, one of the stated goals by the Bush administration was reconciliation with Israel. Has that hope completely vanished?
It's not something that anybody talks about any longer. This was an argument by the neoconservatives in the first Bush administration that the Bush administration didn't need to pay a great deal of attention to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because if the United States changed the equation by overthrowing Saddam Hussein, that the road to a settlement in Jerusalem would go through Baghdad. There is, in fact, no evidence that that has taken place. And, in fact, we see a much worse situation between the Israelis and the Palestinians now, and among the Palestinians as well, within the Palestinian community, than at the beginning of the war with Iraq. It's just a very confused policy, and I think that experts in the region believe that ultimately, as we talked about a little bit earlier in this program, that if the United States returns to being seen as a more of a mediator, an honest broker between the Palestinians and the Israelis, that that could help at least in the wider Middle East. Whether it would have a direct effect on I have my doubts about whether it'll have any kind of direct effect on the war in Iraq.
More callers for Mike Schuster from NPR. Mark is calling from Lynn, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Jane. This is Mark and Lynn. I'm wanting to ask Mike about the history that goes back maybe 200 years to the division of these lands by Western powers to form the existing nations, because these nations were not in existence and they cross many boundaries. I've been living in Estonia and Russia and see the many small nations within Russia and see that the same kinds of things have happened there, that boundaries like between even Syria and Jordan and the other nations, even Saudi Arabia, were formed by Western powers.
Good question, Mark. Thank you for your call, Mike.
Well, this is a result of World War I, essentially, because almost all these lands, not Persia at the time, but all the Arab lands, were part of the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottomans sided with the Germans and fought the Allies. And the British and French were active in the Middle East during World War I, but especially the British. There was in 1916, if I remember my history correctly, an effort to redraw the borders carried out by a British and a French diplomat. It was called the Sykes-Picot Agreement, but those didn't become the actual borders. The actual borders of the Middle East today were determined by the British primarily, and where British troops ended up in the lands that they occupied as a result of World War I. But what they did is they took apart the Ottoman Empire and created separate states. I think that that's important, scholars still argue over the effect that that has had in present day. But I would also say one thing, that the notion of Iraq and Iraqi nationalism seems to still exist. My understanding is that none of the three large communities, Kurds, Shiites, or Sunnis in Iraq, really want to dismantle Iraq. They're all fighting for their version of what Iraq is. Even the Kurds, who have a great deal of autonomy, don't seem to want to completely dismantle the country because of the dangers of outside interference as a result of that. Hmm. So I would say that despite World War I and the fact that the Western powers created the modern Middle East, that the Iraqi factions are fighting for each's version of what Iraq will be in the future.
Mike, I want to go back to a point we discussed a little earlier in the hour about oil, that Shia are a minority in the Muslim world, but they predominate in oil-rich regions in Iraq, in Iran, in Saudi Arabia. There's a story in the New York Times today about a new oil and gas reserves in Anbar, which is about 20 miles from this Syrian border. And the story stresses the potential significance of the political effects, because these reserves are on Sunni land. What are the implications of this and other finds in the future?
Well, some experts have said that one of the reasons the Sunnis are fighting so aggressively within the insurgency to prevent the Shiite government from taking full power in Iraq is because the Shiites live in southern Iraq, where there's a lot of oil, and the Kurds live in northern Iraq, where they have access to the oil and the oil pipeline. But the Sunnis predominate in to the west of Baghdad and in the desert, and there's no oil there. And so they're fighting for a division of resources, oil resources, in Iraq as well. I'm not sure whether that's such a predominant factor, but there are those who do believe it. And if oil has actually been discovered in large quantities in the zones of Iraq that are, where the Sunni live, some people believe that that could help in reconciliation down the line, because the Sunni community might not feel that they have been excluded from the oil resources of Iraq. So wherever oil is in Iraq, clearly that's important, and it may have some kind of effect later on in trying to sort out the political arrangement for Iraq.
Mike Schuster from NPR. Weiss is calling from Toronto, Canada. Weiss, you're on the line. Go ahead. Hello.
Oh, hi. Thank you for finally getting in this program. I know it's very busy. I always listen to this. I really enjoyed the commentaries and everything. I'm from Afghanistan, living in Toronto right now. My mom is Shia, my dad is Sunni. We never had these problems. But it's just the situation is becoming a mess right now. And if, the way I look at it, like the sentiment when I was in Afghanistan, when I was 8 years old, the sentiment when they were fighting the Russians, the sentiment in the streets were when they were done with the Russians, they're going to fight against America. And that's what the sentiments are. The people over there, they watch the news, they see what's going on around the world. And Muslims overall, they're not very happy with the situation that's going on right now. There's smart people, they can choose their own governments, but why is it that Europe and America, they tell people how to, like the governments, they tell them, this is the type of government you should have, and this is the type of trade you should do with us, or else we will disown you, and we will not trade with you, and, we'll, and your people will suffer.
We hear you, Weiss. Thank you. Mike, do you have a response to that?
Well, only that there's so many ironies in the history of all this that the United States backed the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s, who defeated the Soviets, and then some of the Arab fighters who fought among the Mujahideen, like Osama bin Laden, did turn their sights on the United States. And as a result of the attacks in 2001, the United States went to war, first in Afghanistan and then in Iraq. But that led to this deepening conflict between Shia and Sunni. Not an expected outcome or even an outcome that the United States sought. But nevertheless, things like this could happen.
Let me round out the hour, Mike, by asking you a very broad question. The United States said it would be welcomed as liberators in Iraq when we invaded 4 years ago, that the war would be over quickly, Iraq would return to peace. How would an understanding of the history of the Sunnis and the Shiites in Iraq have helped us be more realistic about the outcome of our actions?
Well, it's always difficult to say what to answer the question, what if? I know a lot of historians play that game, and it's so complicated in Iraq and the wider Middle East that I'm not sure that I have a very good answer for you. I would at least say this, that if there was a deeper appreciation of who was likely to come to power in Iraq, that it was likely to be Shiite parties, that that would likely spark a reaction in the Sunni community and a violent reaction. It seemed to me that the United States then might have been better prepared diplomatically to engage with all or much earlier in the region to try to stem this conflict. And it would have meant having to deal directly with Iran, there's no question about it, much earlier, and with Syria. And in fact, we've learned recently that Iran was willing to be engaged, in fact, even sought engagement with the United States right around the time of the U.S. invasion, where the Iranian government asked for direct negotiations with the United States. This was in May of 2003. And I think it was from a position of weakness at that time. If the United States had engaged with Iran, we might have been able to lessen some of these problems and some of the violence. Maybe not, but it would have been worth a try. Now Iran is less interested in that, and it's not clear that the Bush administration is willing to engage in Iran. But we have a much wider abyss to cross now than we did 4 years ago.
Mike Schuster, diplomatic correspondent and foreign correspondent for NPR. His five-part series, The Partisans of Ali, A History of Shia Faith and Politics. Mike, it's been a pleasure having you on. Thank you very much. Fascinating conversation. Thank you.
You're welcome, Jane.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.